That's right. It is glimmer of hope. And my first glimmer of hope would be if Mitch makes a lectern appear roundabout here on the stage. There he is. He's running across the back there. Thanks, Mitch. Producers do a lot. You don't see the producers, but they're a really important part of our service of making stuff run smoothly. Thanks so much, Mitch. So we're leaning into this series, that glimmer of hope. And, you know, I want to share a glimmer of hope with you today that comes amidst a time and a story that is dark. You know, in our culture, the sophisticated thing to say is, you know, if you're in a conversation, talk about a movie, but it's a movie made from a book, you know these people that go, you know, the book is better. You talk about like, oh, have you seen Jurassic Park? Yeah, but the book is better. It's more sophisticated to say the book is better, right? But you know what? Sometimes a movie comes along. I'm not going to say this movie is better than the book, but a movie comes along that uses the medium of film that kind of allows the director to improve on a particular area, on a particular part of the book's narrative design. And I was blown away when I was watching the movie Return of the King, which is the third installment of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And I love Tolkien, I love the books. But I want to share with you this morning a clip that occurs in the last movie of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Take a look. This moment in Tolkien's story, and particularly in the movie Return of the King, you know, you've got the walls coming down with the battering ram, armies encircling the ancient city of Minas Tirith, and it's a bit like quiet in the sound design of the movie, but maybe you heard the words out of Denethor's mouth: Gondor is lost, all has turned to darkness. Everything's going pear-shaped. Everything is going wrong. It's the darkest point in the story. And meanwhile, in the center of this city stands a tree. It's called the White Tree of Gondor. And it only flowers when the rightful king is on the throne of Gondor. And in Tolkien's story, that is something that hasn't happened in 147 years. And yes, I went back to the appendices and looked. Nerd, that's okay. But you notice in this scene that the camera pans to this tree, and it's basically a dead twig. It's a dead tree. Except, of course, for one tiny flower that has budded on this tree. And that doesn't occur in the book. In the book, that tree is dead for the whole book until Aragorn, the rightful king, comes back in and he plants a sapling, a new tree, if you will. But in the movie, Peter Jackson makes this narrative choice of during the darkest point of the movie, the camera pans, Gondor is lost, armies surrounding the city, and the camera pans, and all of a sudden, there's this tiny little flower. Boop. That just blossoms on the tree. I find that image deeply evocative. It tells us that it is often in the moments when everything seems lost that the first tiny glimmer of hope begins to appear. And you know, stories didn't always go this way. In his book, Stories We Tell, Mike Cosper basically makes the point that prior to the Gospels, prior to Christianity, stories were often very different. They were told as warnings. They were told most often as tragedies and tragic explanations of why things go wrong. And even comedies were ironic. The happy ending that we've become so used to is a first century thing, particularly in the Western world. And as this little flower buds on this otherwise dead tree in the darkest moment, it reminds me of a glimmer of hope in the Bible that occurs, I think, in the darkest possible hour. It's in John chapter 13, and we enter this room where Jesus is having the Last Supper, the final meal with his disciples before the cross. The atmosphere is tense. It is tense beyond words, and two things heighten the tension. Judas has just left to go and organize the betrayal of Jesus. And the disciples in the room, they don't understand why. Some of them think that he's going to buy food for the poor or something. But we do, as the audience, because we know the story, right? So we as the reader, we know what he's gone to do. And secondly, Jesus speaks plain as day about his departure. Now, he doesn't say death outright, but his words make it in this chapter unmistakably clear that he is leaving them. So let's read in John 13 verses 31 onwards. We pick it up. As soon as Judas left the room, Jesus said, "The time has come for the Son of Man to enter into his glory, and God will be glorified because of him. And since God receives glory because of the Son, he will give his own glory to the Son, and he will do so at once. Dear children, I will be with you only a little longer. And as I told the Jewish leaders, you will search for me, but you can't come where I am going. So now I am giving you a new commandment. Love each other just as I have loved you. You should love each other. For your love for one another will prove to the world that you are my disciples." Simon Peter asked, "Lord, where are you going?" And Jesus replied, "You can't go with me now, but you will follow me later." "But why can't I come now, Lord?" he asked. "I'm ready to die for you." And on the story goes. And if you know the Easter story, you know, because we talked about this actually at Easter this year. "I'm ready to die for you." Really? Really? We'll see what happens with that. But I want to focus on this chapter this morning. In fact, I want to focus on a single verse, in fact. And that's verse 36, where Simon Peter asks, "Where are you going?" And Jesus replies, "Where I'm going, you cannot follow. But you will follow later." You know, at some point, right, the disciples are realizing something is off. Something is about to happen. It is not good. They don't necessarily know, like we do, that it's in the shadow of the cross. But Jesus is making it clear that he is leaving them. And they are deeply, deeply troubled. We know that they are deeply troubled because later on, at the beginning of chapter 14, Jesus says, "Don't let yourselves be troubled." And the word there that he uses is the same word of Jesus being troubled that he feels when he's standing in front of the tomb of Lazarus. It's a deep, deep anxiety. A deep anxiety. So Peter, he speaks out, as he so often does. Where are you going? Can you hear the desperation in his voice? He's only saying what they're all thinking. Maybe you've prayed something similar. God, where are you going? Or maybe you've prayed, God, where did you go? When he's fallen silent. And you know what? Jesus' answer isn't comforting. He doesn't explain it. He doesn't reassure them. He simply says, where I'm going, you cannot follow. And it's even kind of more brutal than that, because he reminds them of the same thing that he said back to the Pharisees beforehand in a few chapters earlier, when he told them how impossible it was for them to follow him. It lands hard. And so Peter's protest bursts out of this desperation. Why not? Why not? Why can't I follow you? I mean, we've been doing it for the last 3 years. I'm ready to die for you, apparently. But I want to say that right there in the emotional collapse that Peter displays, which I think mirrors what's happening in the hearts of the disciples, a tiny flower appears on an otherwise dead tree. And they are the words from Jesus, but you will follow later. But you will follow later. Don't read over those words too quickly in that passage. A flicker of hope amidst the heartbreak. You will follow me later. What does that mean? Well, what does Peter hear when he hears Jesus say that? Because we sit here 2,000 years later, we can kind of go, well, we know what that means. We know that it's all going to work out okay. They're going to have this like nice walk on the beach after the resurrection. And he's going to end up becoming this one of the leaders of the church. He's going to preach this fully dope sermon, which is going to like see 3,000 people converted. He's going to have a really sore arm from baptizing. Like, that's a big day of baptisms. He's going to become this great leader, this apostle, and he is kind of literally going to follow Jesus in the sense that he will die a very similar death. He is also eventually, according to tradition, crucified, albeit upside down. We don't have time to go into that. But that's not what he hears in this moment. He doesn't know all that. We do. He doesn't. He doesn't know all that yet. What does he hear when Jesus says, you follow? You see, Jesus isn't talking about career milestones or heroism or heroic happy endings. He's talking about presence, relationship, and assurance. You will follow later. How does Peter define the word follow in his mind? Well, what had it meant for him to follow Jesus up to this point? Well, let's have a look. We find that he wasn't just a disciple, he was part of the inner circle. The raising of Jairus' daughter. We'll take the Mark 5 version, Mark 5, 37 to 43. Peter, James, and John get invited in when the others don't, to see this miracle. The Mount of Transfiguration. Not all of them get to go up. Only the select few. But it gets even more intimate, doesn't it? The healing of his own mother-in-law. The coin in the fish's mouth. That's a miracle only he gets to experience. I love it. How convoluted is it? Oh no, we need to pay the temple tax. I tell you what, Peter, go and catch a fish. It's the only time he's any good at fishing, by the way, in the whole Gospels. Go and catch a fish, open its mouth. In the mouth, you'll find a coin. Grab that coin and pay the temple tax. No one else gets to experience that. He got his steps in that day. Speaking of steps, walking on water. How's that for intimate? As he feels himself starting to drown, a hand comes down. That's what follow means to Peter. That's the last 36 months of his life. Peter was used to being that close to Jesus. Basically, the last 3 years he spent most of the time not much more than 14 feet away from Jesus. You will follow me later. You will follow me later. So when Jesus says, I'm going away, his world collapses. Because the literal, like physical, in the same room presence of Jesus has been the foundation of his life ever since he walked away from those nets. And when that happens to you, when you have been in a situation where you said, yes, Lord, I'm going to walk away from my nets, I'm going to follow you, and then all of a sudden it feels like he's going to disappear. What do you do with that? What do you do with that? You listen to these words. It ain't over. You will follow me later. You will follow me later. And that's the flower of hope on an otherwise dead tree. When Jesus says, you will follow me later, he gives more than just a prophecy. He gives a promise. It's an assurance of future presence. It's a guarantee of restored relationship. No matter what is about to happen, and there is a lot, as we now know, on this side of the story, that is about to happen, it will not break open this relationship. It will not shatter this relationship. A pledge, it's a pledge that what seems lost in this moment will one day be whole again. Follow. You know, it's the Greek word, I love saying it, akoulouthio. Akoulouthio. It doesn't just mean to follow. Do you know there's more than one word in Greek for follow? There's actually more than one word in Greek for just about everything, which is annoying. But anyway, there's more than one word in Greek for follow. It does mean to follow, but it can also mean to accompany, to go with. Oh, I'm just going to head off down the shops for a coffee. I'll go with you. Akoulouthēo. You'll be with me again. You'll follow me later. You know, I was talking with my dad about this sermon earlier in the week, and he immediately thought of another flower of hope, glimmer of hope, Luke 22:31-32. Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift all of you as wheat, but I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And this is the important bit. And when, not if, you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. It's not if, it's when you have turned back. Because you see, if you don't get the second part of that verse, the first half or the first part, it's wonderful, but it's not complete. Because there are times when we get information about Jesus, I have prayed for you, that's wonderful, but I'm not worried about your faithfulness, Jesus. I'm worried about mine. I mean, I love the fact that Jesus prays for me and you. I love the fact that he intercedes for us, but does it make a difference? Yes. Here is the guarantee. When you turn back. Friends, I want to tell you that Jesus gives us guarantees about our future even when we can't feel them in the present. Do you know that? He gives us guarantees, because he is God, about our future even when we can't sense them in the present. That is so important. You know, during the week, I was, I don't know where I was. There's so many screens up everywhere now, like advertising screens and stuff just running on the, might have been in a waiting room somewhere. And, it was like more daytime TV, morning show, whatever. And the horoscopes came on. And I'm just like, I'm just watching this. And I'm like, where are you getting this from? But there's a thirst for it, isn't there? Yeah? How do I know it's going to be okay? I need some guarantees. Listen, Jesus gives us guarantees about our future, even when we can't feel them in the present, because he is King. And he is the Alpha and he is the Omega. But like Alicia reminded us a few weeks ago, these glimmers of hope are often hidden under the dirt. Sometimes you got to dig. Sometimes the dirt that hides them is our own emotional state in the moment. I don't know what you're going through. I don't know what situation is on the horizon for you. But maybe that's the dirt you've got to dig through in order to see the glimmer of hope. But like a single white flower on that tree, they are still there. They bloom even when, sometimes especially when, everything seems lost. You know, maybe you feel like Jesus' voice has gone silent. You know, sometimes I say this stuff to people I meet with that are about 3 or 4 weeks after their baptism. There's nothing more dangerous when you come off a spiritual high. And it's like, oh, okay. Oh, real life. But no matter what is happening, friends, even if Sauron is encircling your city, and I doubt that he is, you worship the King. You worship the Alpha and the Omega. And when he speaks to you, he speaks to you from the end of history, because he is the Lord of it. And he does not address you according to who you are now. He does not address you according to your current strength of faith. He does not address you according to the depth of intimacy you feel with him today. He speaks to you according to who he knows you will become, standing in glory before him one day. Isn't that good news? You are not now who you shall one day be. You are not now who you shall one day be. So we're released to stop looking at our inadequacies and to fix our eyes on him alone. The author to the Hebrews says, fix your eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and the perfecter. He'll do it. Just one step at a time. The pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. You know, Peter has no idea, right, that the reason why Jesus is being ripped from his grasp in that moment is his sin, John's sin, James's sin, Thomas's sin, my sin, your sin. The cross was necessary. But that's the glory of God. He does what we cannot do, even if it means him having to be silent for a while. Back to that white flower. In the movie, in the clip that we saw, that little flower blooms during a scene called the Pyre of Denethor. And in the book, you know, this is my have you read the book moment? In the book, that chapter is one of the most interwoven moments in Tolkien's timeline. And while
that is happening. And it is the darkest moment in the book. It's not just the army around the city and the battering ram. It is, as you saw, Denethor taking his unconscious son to be burned alive. It's a murder-suicide. That's what's happening in the book. But in that moment, in that dark moment, do you know what else is happening in the chronology of the story? Aragorn, the rightful king, is riding up the river with his army. In other words, the flower is signaling something. And it's very simple. The king is on his way. The king is on his way. Maybe you just need to hear that. The king is on his way. He is on his way. Because friends, that's the reality we live in. The king is on his way. And if we just stay faithful to him, he can give guarantees about your future because he knows what he's doing. He's on his way and he knows what he is doing. You are not now who you shall one day be. Live out of who you will be. Let me just finish this morning by maybe asking you two questions. I'm going to sing a song in a second that has a line in it. In darkest nights, you are closer like no other. Do you know someone in your life who needs to hear this assurance that the king is on his way? Do you know someone in your life this week who needs this message? Go and tell them. Go and tell them. Spread the good news. As we sing this, I want you to think of that person. Or maybe you are that person. Ask yourself this. What step would you be able to take this week if you knew that you knew that you knew that you were going to end up following Jesus? That you were going to end up glorified, standing in glory before him, reunified with him. The king is on his way, and you are not now who you shall one day be.